You're listening to the CyberWire Network, powered by N2K.
In the dynamic world of enterprise security, identity architects and IT leaders face a major challenge. Growth by repeated acquisitions multiplies the complexity of everything. Multiple IDPs, MFA providers, policy engines that all need to coexist. This can lead to fragmented user identities and policies that create security vulnerabilities and add access friction. Strata Identity solves this. Now you can decommission unneeded IDPs and consolidate the ones you'd like to keep without rewriting apps or disrupting users, engineers, and app owners. Plus, Strata's modular architecture makes it easy to integrate with any identity provider without manual maintenance and coding. Join the ranks of cybersecurity leaders using identity orchestration. Visit strata.io/cyberwire, share your top identity security priorities, and receive a pair of complimentary AirPods Pro. Offer valid for organizations with over 5,000 employees. Step into a new era of identity management at strata.io/cyberwire. The U.S. announces a broad range of retaliatory actions designed to impose costs on Russia for its recent actions in cyberspace. More reports on the Natanz incident suggest that a buried bomb was remotely detonated. David DeFore from Webroot has a wake-up call on digital privacy. Our guest is Ganesh Pai from Uptix on MITRE attack evaluations. And Iced ID is taking Emotet's place in the criminal ecosystem. From the CyberWire studios at DataTribe, I'm Dave Bittner with your CyberWire summary for Thursday, April 15, 2021. Today's cyber news is dominated by this morning's announcement of a broad range of U.S. responses to Russian operations in cyberspace. The U.S. administration this morning announced the long-expected set of measures designed to impose costs on Russian threat actors for both election influence operations, for the SolarWinds compromise, and for other cyber campaigns. The steps taken include sanctions and diplomatic expulsions, and of course, naming and shaming. U.S. President Biden signed an executive order today intending, quote, to demonstrate the administration's resolve in responding to and deterring the full scope of Russia's harmful foreign activities, end quote. The White House statement frames the order as a signal that the United States will impose costs in a strategic and economically impactful manner on Russia if it continues or escalates its destabilizing international actions. The objectionable Russian actions include efforts to undermine elections and democratic institutions, and that elections not only in the U.S., but voting in unspecified allied countries. It also includes various other violations of international law, including respect for the territorial integrity of states. Russia's continuing occupation of Ukrainian territory in Crimea is the principal offense against territorial integrity. The White House cites the cooperation of the European Union, the United Kingdom, Australia, and Canada in imposing sanctions against 8 individuals and entities associated with that occupation. With tension rising between Russia and Ukraine, and with menacing Russian troop movements in the region, unilateral Russian provocations along the line of contact in eastern Ukraine, in occupied Crimea, and along Ukraine's borders, the White House statement calls them, the administration made an unambiguous statement of support for Ukraine. Quote, the transatlantic community stands united in supporting Ukraine against, as well as agreeing on the need for Russia to immediately cease its military buildup and inflammatory rhetoric. End quote. The White House, NSA, the FBI, and CISA all formally attributed the SolarWinds compromise to Russia's Foreign Intelligence Service, the SVR. To make the attribution utterly clear, they cite the names industry has used to refer to its cyber operations, APT-29, Cozy Bear, and The Dukes. That attribution is offered with high confidence. The administration notes that this software supply chain compromise gave the SVR the ability to either spy on or disrupt more than 16,000 systems worldwide, and that most of the affected systems belong to the private sector. NSA's statement described mitigation of known vulnerabilities in the SolarWinds Orion software supply chain, WellMess malware used against COVID-19 researchers, and network attacks exploiting a VMware vulnerability. NSA's cybersecurity directorate tweeted a warning that Russia's SVR is actively exploiting 5 publicly known vulnerabilities against U.S. and allied networks. NSA's Director of Cybersecurity, Rob Joyce, joined us on the line earlier today and provided this statement.
Today, NSA released a joint advisory with the FBI and DHS's CISA. We highlighted cyber vulnerabilities that have been the target of exploitation by the Russian Foreign Intelligence Service, the SVR. The vulnerabilities in today's release are part of the SVR's toolkit to target networks across the government and private sectors. We need to make SVR's job harder by taking them away. NSA is urging rapid mitigation by system owners to make attempts at malicious actions less likely to succeed.
The SolarWinds incident is particularly troubling because it was a software supply chain compromise that enabled organizations to be targeted easily and at will. The White House thinks this should serve as a warning about the risks of using information and communications technology and services supplied by companies that operate or store user data in Russia, or rely on software developments or remote technical support by personnel in Russia. To address those risks, the U.S. government is considering action under Executive Order 13873, the Better to Protect the Information and Communications Technology and Services Supply Chain against Russian exploitation. The U.S. State Department is expelling 10 Russian diplomats in connection with this activity, the AP reports. The White House statement says the 10 come from Russia's diplomatic mission in Washington and include representatives of Russian intelligence services. And the U.S. Department of the Treasury announced today that it was sanctioning 16 entities and 16 individuals who attempted to influence the 2020 U.S. presidential election at the direction of the leadership of the Russian government. 4 front media organizations associated with 3 Russian intelligence and security services are singled out as disinformation shops. South Front, the FSB, News Front, FSB, InfoRoss, GRU, and the Strategic Culture Foundation, SVR. Pursuant to today's executive order, Treasury now prohibits U.S. financial institutions from participating in the market for any bonds Russia might issue after this coming June 14th. 6 Russian tech companies that support the Russian intelligence services' cyber programs are being sanctioned. And of course, the actions taken by the U.S. today have implications for the evolution of international norms of conduct in cyberspace. The White House statement affirmed the importance of an open, interoperable, secure, and reliable internet, which it regards as a goal shared by most of the international community, U.S. allies and partners in particular, but which Russian actions undermine. To foster the development of a stable, secure cyberspace, the White House outlined 2 actions. Quote, first, the United States is bolstering its efforts to promote a framework of responsible state behavior in cyberspace and to cooperate with allies and partners to counter malign cyber activities. End quote. An important part of that will involve training for policymakers and international lawyers on the policy and technical aspects of publicly attributing cyber incidents. The U.S. will begin organizing such training at the George C. Marshall Center in Garmisch, Germany. The training will extend beyond the details of attribution and cover international norms of conduct in cyberspace. Second, the White House says they are reinforcing their commitment to collective security in cyberspace. This involves joint military training in CyberFlag 21-1, a combined exercise that aims at improving cyber defense capabilities and resilience. The UK, France, Denmark, and Estonia, at least, will participate. The Jerusalem Post reports that the sabotage at Iran's Natanz uranium enrichment facility, widely attributed to Israel by both the Iranian government and Israeli media, was produced by a remotely detonated explosive device. And finally, January's Emotet takedown by law enforcement left a gap in the criminal ecosystem, now being partially filled by the Iced ID gang, the Record reports. Iced ID began with familiar spam campaigns back in 2017, distributing what the Record calls a classic banking Trojan. But it's evolved and now functions as a malware as a service operation. Hey everybody, today I want to highlight a name that all of us know well, and that is our sponsor, Splunk. You need to keep operations humming around the clock, but potential disruptions are everywhere. Splunk helps you predict problems and find and fix issues fast so you can reduce risk and ditch downtime. The world's largest enterprises rely on Splunk's unified security and observability platform to become more efficient, resilient, and innovative. With Splunk, you can react quickly, evolve faster, and be ready for anything. Stay ahead of disruptions. Learn more at splunk.com/resilience. And we thank Splunk for sponsoring our show. And now, a word from our sponsor, Zscaler, the leader in cloud security. Cyber attackers are using AI in creative ways to compromise users and breach organizations. In a security landscape where you must fight AI with AI, the best AI protection comes from having the best data. Zscaler has extended its zero-trust architecture with powerful AI engines that are trained and tuned by 500 trillion daily signals. Learn more about Zscaler Zero Trust Plus AI to prevent ransomware and AI attacks. Experience your world secured. Visit zscaler.com/zero-trust-AI. The IT world used to be simpler. You only had to secure and manage environments that you controlled. Then came new technologies and new ways to work. Now, employees, apps, and networks are everywhere. This means poor visibility, security gaps, and added risk. That's why Cloudflare created the first-ever connectivity cloud. Visit cloudflare.com to protect your business everywhere you do business. Our own Rick Howard checked in with Ganesh Pai from Uptix for his views on MITRE attack evaluations. Here's Rick Howard.
I got the chance to talk to Ganesh Pai, the CEO of Uptix, an SQL-powered security analytics platform, about his company's recent participation in the MITRE attack evaluation program. This relatively new program from MITRE invites security vendors to bring their solutions into an environment so that the MITRE lab rats can throw actual adversary campaigns at them to see if the vendor can detect and prevent them. In this evaluation, MITRE deployed the attack campaigns used by the adversary group Fin7, also known as Carbonac, a financially motivated threat group that has primarily targeted the U.S. retail, restaurant, and hospitality sectors since mid-2015. I asked Ganesh why he thought the MITRE attack campaign was good for the industry.
It's one of those approaches where there is a third party who is neutral and objective. They have a common evaluation criteria, and they call it as MITRE ATTCK Enterprise Evaluations. They set up an environment, and they work with the vendors to say, do your best. We're going to be doing this pre-canned set of things to do something malicious, and we'll see how well your solution measures up against the framework. So they're doing two things. One, giving you a nice framework so that everyone uses the same language. And second, they provide an approach for evaluation where there's a third party objectively providing a quantifiable approach to demonstrating value. They don't rank stack you. They just collect all the data as a part of their findings and present it. And what's nice is they allow those who want to procure technology to objectively evaluate the outcomes. We placed a bet on this quantitative approach to measure even the efficacy of our solution, because given the number of vendors out there, we wanted to stand out. And as I said, for us to show something demonstrable in a quantifiable way was important.
In these kinds of things, disagreements between the evaluator and the evaluated always happen. I asked Ganesh about how UPDICS worked things out with MITRE when they did.
They upfront said Carbonac and Fin7 are the two techniques and tactics that we're going to be evaluating vendors against. Mm-hmm. They also outlined that here is around 159 or 160 or that we expect you to hit relative to the number of detections. When we actually went into the evaluation, our experience was actually very nice. They were quite objective when there was any disconnect, and the disconnect was very straightforward. We might not have set a flag right or tuned something because we had the ability to capture the telemetry, but we may not have displayed a finding for one out of the 160 or something like that. Mm-hmm. And they were nice enough to say that this is what we didn't visibly see on your screen. We looked at it and said, look, oh, here's this tuning flag which was missing. We set that right, and we were fortunate that then they said, yeah, this looks good. Other people's mileage might vary, but if we were to use our engagement with MITRE, it was a very pleasant and a very collaborative one to iron out any differences in opinion.
Clearly, for a vendor, this is an investment in time and resources. I asked Ganesh what it took to get ready.
They outline what the set of techniques are as a series of columns which are laid out one after the other. And then there is the notion of tactics given a technique. For a given sub-tactic, there can be 10 or 15 or even more approaches to doing the detection of that tactic.
If anybody has heard me speak before, you know that I'm a big fan of crafting prevention controls for all known adversary behavior across the intrusion kill chain. Unfortunately, most of us, vendors and practitioners alike, focus on the technical details of preventing malware and exploits and ransomware, and not on defeating the actual adversary. The MITRE Attack Evaluation Program seems to be a step in the right direction. I asked Ganesh if he thought going through this exercise would change how his engineering team adds new features to his products in the future.
The set of things that we came up for detecting Carbonac and Fin7 during the evaluations are fairly generic. The detection for each of the tactics have been coded in a way such that if they get reformulated ever to do a detection of another one, that it's not going to be a whole lot of work for us. The engineering work and the 3 months that we put in is generic enough that it gives a return on investment for a long time to come.
I'm a fan of the MITRE Attack Evaluation Program, and it sounds like Ganesh and UPDICS is too. If you agree, it might be a good idea to encourage all of the vendors you have deployed in your own security stack to participate in the next one. You might even suggest that it will be a precondition before you renew the contract at the next iteration.
That's the CyberWire's Rick Howard speaking with Ganesh Pai from UPDICS.
Managing the requirements for modern security programs is increasingly challenging and time-consuming. Enter Vanta. Vanta gives you one place to centralize and scale your security program. Quickly assess risk, streamline security reviews, and automate compliance for ISO 27001, SOC 2, and more. You can leverage Vanta's market-leading trust management platform to unify risk management and secure the trust of your customers. Plus, use Vanta AI to save time when completing security questionnaires. CyberWire daily listeners can get $1,000 off by going to vanta.com/cyber. That's vanta.com/cyber.
And I'm pleased to be joined once again by David DeFore. He is the Vice President of Engineering and Cybersecurity at Webroot. David, always great to have you back.
Great to be here, David, as always.
I wanted to touch on the recent hack we saw on Verkada and how that was kind of a wake-up call when it comes to folks' digital privacy. What thoughts do you have on that?
You know, I'm not going to kind of call out Verkada because they're the ones in this instance. They got caught with an issue with a super admin password. But I got to tell you, I promise you, there are a lot of organizations with this same problem. They just haven't been caught yet. So I'm not necessarily saying obviously they did something wrong, but I'm not saying that they're the only ones and we need to point a finger. This is really another touch point, a time where we all need to be aware of what's possible. If someone's able to get into something and get, I mean, if you're not familiar, you know, they got access to 150,000 live cameras and they were showing footage for different organizations to media and stuff like that. So it was a big deal, but we're all affected by this.
Yeah. I mean, how do you come at something like a hard-coded credential? I mean, is that, you have folks out there hunting for that proactively?
Yeah, you know, this, and David, you know, a lot of the engineers who work for me would laugh at this comment, but I used to write code. And really what you've got to, believe it or not, this really starts with the engineers. You have to have a good process in place because that analyzes code, that is ensuring you're not, you know, doing things like hard coding passwords. Because when you're first bootstrapping something, trying to test something, you really just want to quickly get things up and running. But you got to have peer reviews, you've got to have code scans. So it really starts there and then goes out from there at different layers of ensuring that people are protected.
Yeah, because I mean, isn't it accurate that a lot of times those things get put in as part of the development process, again, for the convenience of the developers, but then once it goes into production, it should be pulled out, and that doesn't always happen.
That's exactly what the case is. And a lot of times, David, believe it or not, it's included for convenience in like raw source code SDKs, and they say change this once you get it up and running so that you're safe, and a lot of programmers don't take the time, even, you know, when you're using that third-party tool. So you're exactly right. It's just a function of a lot of us want to get stuff working, and believe it or not, security sometimes takes a backseat to stuff, David. We've never seen that before, right?
What are your thoughts for the folks downstream who found themselves victim of this? You know, your classic sort of third-party thing where, you know, I've contracted with a company like Verkada, and because they weren't doing things 100%, now, you know, the footage of my factory floor is on the nightly news.
That is the problem. And you've put it in a nutshell. How do you verify? And, you know, just like in society where we want to go to the grocery store or the pharmacist, you have to have trust at some level, and these things will happen. And then the question is, how do you recover from it? You have to have processes in place that vet your third parties, and you're making sure that the tools you bring in are as secure as possible, because you can only do it as best as you can. And again, that looks that's that whole process, depending on the size of your organization. Are you able to vet it? Can you, what's your exposure if the stuff gets out? Look, if you have a factory floor and they're watching a guy drive a forklift, you're probably not worried too much about it. But if you have a customized manufacturing process where one of these cameras is watching that and it's intellectual property, you probably want to make sure maybe you don't buy the cheapest available system out there. You need to make sure there's something that's been vetted and potentially certified that it is secure.
Yeah. Yeah, it's sort of an object lesson in this whole thing of the supply chain and, from supply chain issues to embedded passwords, there's something for everybody here.
There absolutely is. And it goes back to, we have to trust, but we can verify. And a lot of times cost gets in the way of that verification process. And we just need to be aware of it. And this goes for consumers as well, David. I mean, people put stuff in their homes and they connect it to their Wi-Fi and they don't know what's going on. They don't know if it's calling home to some country where they'd freak out if it was. We just have to spend more time understanding. And it's easy not to, because we all get busy.
Yeah. All right. Well, David Dufour, thanks for joining us.
Hey, great being here, David.
And that's the CyberWire. For links to all of today's stories, check out our daily briefing at thecyberwire.com. And for professionals and cybersecurity leaders who want to stay abreast of this rapidly evolving field, sign up for CyberWire Pro. It'll save you time and keep you informed. It's not just a job, it's an adventure. Listen for us on your Alexa smart speaker, too. The CyberWire podcast is proudly produced in Maryland out of the startup studios of Data Tribe, where they're co-building the next generation of cybersecurity teams and technologies. Our amazing CyberWire team is Elliot Peltzman, Peru Prakash, Kelsey Bond, Tim Nodar, Joe Kerrigan, Carol Terrio, Ben Yellen, Nick Vilecki, Gina Johnson, Bennett Moe, Chris Russell, John Petrick, Jennifer Iben, Rick Howard, Peter Kilpie, and I'm Dave Bittner. Thanks for listening. We'll see you back here tomorrow.